Some of the biggest brands in digital media are in turmoil. Vice News is near bankruptcy. Twitter is a mess. BuzzFeed shut down its news department last month. Ben Smith thinks this signals the end of an era. He was the editor-in-chief at BuzzFeed News until 2020, and yes, he was there in 2017 when BuzzFeed published that controversial dossier about then-just-elected President Trump and his alleged conspiracy with the Russians. Ben now leads a news outlet called Semaphore, and he's also written a new book called Traffic: Genius, Rivalry, and Delusion in the Billion-Dollar Race to Go Viral. Ben Smith, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
And why don't we start with BuzzFeed? As someone who knows the inner workings of that organization as well as anyone, what went wrong?
A lot of things went wrong. There were a lot of mistakes and bad business decisions, but the core thing that went wrong was really a big bet on social media. And I think, when I started in 2012, we believed that social media was going to become this massive new distribution channel for news, for entertainment, and that a new wave of media companies would be able to sort of create great businesses and great journalism on it. The way CNN, ESPN, MTV had grown up in the 80s around cable.
So a lot has happened to social media since then, but what was the thing that happened to social media that caused this rupture?
The big social media companies, notably Facebook, never embraced professionally created content. They wanted user-generated content. It's free for them, among other things. And particularly news proved so divisive and troubling for them and kept getting their executives hauled up onto Capitol Hill, that I think both they backed away from news and a lot of users have sort of started to leave those platforms. And I think they are not permanent features of the landscape we thought they would be.
Let's talk about why BuzzFeed News and other digital media outlets, why they worked so well for a while. Because at its best, BuzzFeed was this incredibly powerful force. It didn't just do good journalism that won awards. I'm also thinking of the viral dress post from 2015, which, at the time we covered as a major news story on this show. And for people who don't remember, the question is this dress blue and black or is it white and gold? It kind of broke the internet. What did you learn from that moment?
Essentially this kind of harmless, sweet web culture was becoming this just massive global phenomenon. And you had this, I thought, quite delightful thing where everyone in the world was having a heated argument about whether the dress, from a picture taken at a wedding in Scotland, was white and gold or blue and black. What was so interesting is Jonah Peretti, the founder of BuzzFeed, not that long afterward had a conversation with a senior executive at Facebook, basically saying, how cool was this? You guys, created this big moment of global culture. And the executive said, well, I don't know. How often do you think we ought to let that happen? Which was kind of a surprise to us, that it made them nervous.
Why did it make them nervous?
Well, I think this sense that they could totally lose control of what was being distributed on their platform in 5 minutes, before they would have time to even notice, everyone in the world would have seen something. And I think that was also at the moment when really divisive politics were starting to spread really fast on these platforms, and they were starting to take criticism for it.
Well, in fact, your book suggests that this pursuit of traffic and this mix of social media and news helped unleash these dark forces that would eventually overtake the internet and even our society. What did it do to our culture and to our politics?
When I went back, a lot of the origins of the internet and of this kind of internet media were kind of among Democrats, young people, progressives. But, when you step back, the movement that has actually been best suited to these tools is this new right-wing populism, is Donald Trump's movement, where pushing the boundaries, transgression, lying in order to provoke a confrontation are, core to that movement and following the traffic wherever it goes without worrying that you might be damaging institutions or norms in the process.
To that point, we're talking about politics now. When you consider your decision at BuzzFeed to publish the Steele dossier after the 2016 election, now this, for people who don't remember, was the document that was full of salacious and, a lot of unconfirmed allegations about Donald Trump and Russia. Do you think in retrospect that you were caught up in some of those forces that were corrupting digital media?
I continue to think that was the right call. we would never have published it had it not already been reported that there was this secret document, that two presidents had been briefed on it, Trump and Obama, and that it contained these specific damning allegations about Trump and the Russians, that it was credible. That had all been reported by CNN. To me, that was sort of, that was the trigger for publishing it.
I hear that, and you write about this moment in the book when you publish this dossier and you watch it, you literally watch it go viral. So to me, I just wonder if part of it wasn't also about the clicks.
To me, the thing that I regret about that was more when we watched it travel, what we were watching really travel was a PDF document that we'd posted to the internet. We'd also posted on the web a disclaimer, kind of a caveat lector saying, you know, this, as you said, this thing is unverified. In fact, there's some specific errors in it that make us nervous. That stayed on our website. The document kind of traveled off to have a career of its own, and I do think we could have done a better job stamping the disclaimer on the document. Although I think in the end, it was disturbing to watch people take it as gospel, and that wasn't how we intended it.
Yeah. Let's talk about Twitter, which is responsible for a lot of stories going viral, driving traffic, at least in the past. This is always a platform that had more influence than users, but now it's suddenly a very different place under Elon Musk. What do you think is going to happen to Twitter, and how does that fit into what we've been talking about here?
Yeah, I mean, Twitter was the beating heart of news, the central kind of elite conversation in a way among politicians and journalists and people like that. And I think had already, I think in these social platforms like Facebook, like Twitter, they're social institutions like bars or nightclubs. You go there because your friends are there, and they're very fragile. Your friends start leaving and you leave. You don't really need a good reason. And I think you'd already started to see that happen. Is people just tired of this era of the internet? And I think Musk came in and he probably accelerated that decline. And that isn't to say it'll go away, right? But it's already sort of losing its hold as being the central place that news and politics are discussed, and that's kind of splintering. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe that is closer to historical norms, that we aren't just all in one giant public square screaming at each other.
But social media is not dead or just changing.
People are spending way less time on what we used to think of as social media. I mean, TikTok, which is the huge new platform, is not exactly social media, right? It's mostly, you mostly consume on it. It's not mostly a sort of messaging, talking to other people platform. It's more passive. A lot of people are in text groups with their friends or all sorts of other more private spaces, Discord groups that, you know, you could call social, you could call messaging, but I think that age of the big public social internet really is fading.
So let's talk about what's next. As one chapter closes on an era of digital media, you have a new startup. It's called Semaphore. It's a news organization that, from what I can tell, has kind of rethought the format of a traditional news article. It delivers content from pretty well-known journalists through email and newsletters, which is interesting because to me that seems like it is the antithesis of virality. Do you agree? Was that by design?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, as I said, I think all those impulses that made people dive headfirst into this new internet media, which is to say, it was so exciting to sort of have all these voices that you could reach. Now, I think that has turned into a situation where we're all overwhelmed and are looking for trusted sources who will be really transparent about who they are, what they think, what their opinions are, and who will also, go out and read the crazy, chaotic social media so you don't have to. And bring in other points of view and provide that to you in a way that is saner and in some ways, reflective, not exactly of the old print formats, but of the old print values where you have an editor saying, hey, here's what I think is important.
I thought we were done with email, but you're not.
No, I think email has really reemerged as this very central delivery vehicle for news right now as social media fades very, very rapidly. And there are all sorts of ways of getting news. And as you say, email is exactly one of them that are not particularly viral, but that people find really satisfying or connecting with audiences, but in much more private, limited spaces.
Ben Smith is the author of Traffic, Genius, Rivalry, and Delusion in the Billion-Dollar Race to Go Viral. Ben, thank you very much. Appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me on.